they're keeping these things tight to the vest, I would assume ultimately they'll publish them. But so far, I haven't been able to grab anything useful on the Internet.
AC2GS in the group AC2PL. Yeah, I might be able to provide you with, how shall we say, some information. I think that I'll leave it at that. Someone that I know is actually working on the marketing and the pre-launch of that particular drug. So I'll see what I can find, Roy. And this is AC2PL. Thank you very much for your contribution, and I'll be clear.
Thank you, Jeff. And I would appreciate any information because I'm as confused as the next guy. But I do have an interesting kind of point-counterpoint story to tell after this one. But I'll ask if anyone else has any questions or comments on this subject before I move to a ever so slightly different one. Very well. The Russian vaccine study was published in The Lancet just last week. It was a phase 1 and 2 trial involving an entire 78 healthy volunteers in total who received one of two formulations of the experimental vaccine that they've codenamed Sputnik V. There were no reports of serious adverse events among the volunteers, meeting the primary goal of these early clinical trials, and there was also evidence that the volunteers developed the immune response to SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus that theoretically should protect them from infection. The results were largely welcomed by the scientific community at first, given the previous lack of any published evidence on Sputnik V, which Russian authorities already approved for use a month earlier. Seemingly based on this data, it's still unclear whether this approval will actually result in the country's residents having access to the COVID-19 vaccine any sooner than people in other countries. A phase 3 trial of Sputnik V started in late August, which is usually the last step of clinical research needed before a treatment can be brought to the market. In an open letter to The Lancet and the study's author, signed by over 35 scientists and released this week, researchers claim they are a bit suspicious of the data presented in the Lancet paper. The letter is predominantly signed by scientists involved in immunology, biology, and drug development, and includes those based in Europe, North America, and Venezuela. There was one Russian doctor, Max Trushin, who is a microbiologist and geneticist at Kazan University. Let me drop for a sec. The letter highlights aspects of the data that they call fishy, if you will, in so many words. The volunteers were split into several treatment groups, testing variations of the vaccine that were either frozen or freeze-dried or only receiving one half of the vaccine's two-dose strategy for safety testing. The letter points to figures showing some of these different treatment groups having very similar or even identical levels of antibodies or other immune responses post-inoculation. In other cases, the level of antibodies don't seem to decline at all in the same group during the study's length, which ran for over a month. They were also concerned about the lack of information available on a group of people with documented COVID-19 presented in the study that used to compare against the immune responses of the vaccinated group. By itself, any one of these things may not seem like a big deal. But though the experts don't go as far as explicitly accusing the study's researchers of fraud, they do conclude that the fact of observing so many data points preserved among different experiments is highly unlikely. The letter calls for an investigation into the study by Lancet, along with the release of the study's raw data on individual level to help settle these questions. According to a statement released by The Lancet, the letter has been shared with the study's authors, and the publisher is now encouraging them to please engage in the scientific discussion. Ah, those wild and wacky rookies. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2GS.
Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, this is very much unfortunate. Everything over there is lion corrupted and politically motivated. Russian vaccine named Sputnik V are the Soviet era space program. Yes. One person have received it, and it was President's daughter. She feels well, and the concentration of antibody is high, said Putin. The main thing is to ensure unconditional safety. So that was one of the things that was announced. But on August 12, 2020, Russia became the first country in the world to approve vaccine against severe respiratory syndrome coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. The vaccine, which is based on two adenovirus vectors, was developed by Gamaleya, a National Center of Epidemiology and Microbiology, Moscow, Russia. Its approval was announced by President Vladimir Putin. I know that the vaccine works quite effectively, helps to develop strong immunity, and has gone through all necessary tests, declared Putin at the cabinet meeting. Nonetheless, there are widespread concerns that the approval is premature. At the time of approval, the vaccine had not even started phase 3 trials, nor had any results on the earlier stage trials being published. Since then, the phase 1 and 2 results have been published in the Lancet. The vaccine induced a strong immune response in all 76 participants. Presumably, those results were available for Russian military of help. But the problem is that Putin forcibly wants to inject people with that vaccine, especially military, or the people that are on the government pay stubs. And by that, he wants to use the results to further make it better. I am strongly concerned about the fact that he wants to experiment on people and judge the effectiveness of a vaccine based on number of deaths and still alive. Enter a cheer.
Yes, Wesley, I agree with all that you said. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, if you mix science with politics, you end up getting politics. And this is a political thing now. It's no longer a medical thing. And I don't know what to make of it, and I wish the Russian citizens well and hope they survive this. Unfortunately, or what have you, you can't really take anyone at their word, and so it's possible that his daughter was vaccinated. It's possible his daughter wasn't vaccinated. It's possible all these numbers are real. It's equally possible that someone just made them all up. And whether that means that push comes to shove in a month or so, if he's going to line up everyone in Mother Russia and give them an injection, maybe, but maybe not. Who knows? I can't fathom the gentleman, but I wouldn't trust him. But it's sort of a shame. It's always a shame when politics gets involved in science, and I've always said that, and I'll stick to it. It's always good when politics is able to speed up the gears of bureaucracy, but some gears need to be there. You go too fast, you break the gears. So I wish them well, but this is not a good sign.
As a contract for regulators such as U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and European Medicine Agency, data on immune response alone would not generally be an adequate basis for approving the vaccine. Immune response might not be directly proportional to the degree of protection. You can only find this out in large-scale trials. And that is the opinion of Peter Openshaw, professor of experimental medicine at Imperial College London, in London, UK. The vaccine production is has long-standing history in Soviet-era space program, but most of the technology was stolen from Western world, and it was typical to Russia. Not going to the political, the Russian vaccine named Sputnik 5 of the Soviet era space program, one person have received it in the president, and it was presidential daughter. But there are unconfirmed cases of dozens of people who died and dozens of people becoming severely sick. That's why President Putin decided to give the vaccine to the young and healthy in hope that the results will not be immediately criticized. And to Exia.
Okay, I don't know how much of this is real, how much of this imaginary. I mean, I wouldn't be unduly surprised if he was just giving people injections of salt water and then shrugging. I don't know what's going on there. It's kind of sad that these things are being forced and hurried up. And as I've mentioned before, vaccines can be detrimental. In the case of the swine flu vaccine back in the late 70s, it was giving people Guillain-Barré. There have been test vaccines for other infections that when they were given to lab animals, instead of fighting off the infection, when you expose the animal to the infectious agent, they had a runaway inflammatory process and quickly died, which is not exactly what you wanted out of a vaccine. So vaccines are dangerous. I hope they're not doing something excessively silly and dangerous, but time will tell.
One more thing. Mass production is expected to begin September 2020. Russia, which has seen almost 1 million cases of COVID-19, said that it would be able to provide 500 million doses of Sputnik V or Sputnik 5 per year, knowing that a real population of Russia out of claimed 146 million is about 81 million, and the rest of them are Asian, mostly immigrants that are working in Russia, sometimes in slavery conditions. Putin wants to vaccine those immigrants, and because it's going to be 500 million doses, he's going to also vaccine animals, especially from a group of mammals. We might see, let me drop, since a human being belongs to a group of mammals, we may see interaction between sick animals and still healthy humans, and reverse of it because of this vaccine. It's a crime against the humanity, and if it's proven that it's wrong, I don't know how Mr. Putin can be pushed to stand in front of Hague court for persecution and to exile.
Yes, it's Jeff.
Yes, Jeff.
The question of the reservoir in animals is interesting, particularly considering the fact that this virus came from a bat population in some eastern regions. The question of inaccuracies quickly published because of the excitement of, and the urgency of the issue are well known. We published a paper recently in an open access unreviewed bioarchive, and it was called under question, and fortunately we had the opportunity to rebut the question, which were not politically motivated, but how shall we say, motivated by a rivalry, scientific rivalry, That was interesting as well, Roy, and I'll tell you about that later via email. But yeah, it's just publishing and getting the information out has become challenging for something really we should come together and combat, right?
I agree, but, you know, egos are egos, and you can go back to the history books of science, and there were a lot of ego-driven feuds of things that didn't sound at all like they lent themselves to egos, and yet there was hatred among some scientists for each other because what they were, what they believed, who their friends were, what organization they belonged to. It's terrible. But, you know, it's the process of science. Science usually does best, all things being equal, when it's challenged. Because it rises it to a higher level of clarity, I think. By understanding, it could get tiresome being attacked for no apparent reason. But, you know, going back to Russia, I mean, you got to understand that this is a country that gave us Uncle Joe Stalin. So, you know, they have a long history of leaders doing very dubious things.
Hey, C2PL. Yeah, quite. I have many Russian colleagues here in the States, and you'll notice that they're no longer in the in the Soviet Union or in the Russian states, and they're here for a reason. They escaped, and they are doing their science here under the typical U.S. conditions. Many, many very good scientists, but over there. Politically driven, anything really can happen. Roy, go ahead.
Yeah, the thing is that Russia approved large-scale clinical trials of the vaccine involving 40,000 people, and it was scheduled to begin in Russia in last week of August, and a number of countries such United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, the Philippines, possibly India and Brazil will join the clinical trials of Sputnik V. And that's troubling. That's absolutely troubling. Because if there is a criminal activity or unchecked activity on Russian side affecting people, still people, they are Russian, that is a kind of tragedy to Russian nation. But why then going with that to other countries, especially to Brazil? If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So he wants to kill a few hundred thousand of people in order to make a progress. It's unbelievable. And to achieve.
Well, the history book is filled with people who do terrible things that are unbelievable. Yeah, I think a lot of this is propaganda ploy. Naming it Sputnik V, offering it for the world at an endless supply. Can Russia manufacture 500 million vials of vaccine a year? Probably not. But it's all propaganda. If anyone falls for the propaganda, I'm not quite sure. I think these other countries are more clever than that, especially when the guys running the medical aspects read these notes in the Lancet and such. So I don't think it's going to be that much of a problem outside of the Russian Federation, but I pity those poor people. And, you know, they've just been living through hell for a couple of centuries to the point where I don't think they know the difference between hell and a more decent way of life. It went from the Tsars to Stalin and just on from there. Anyway, I think we did enough. Anyone with any closing statements before I close this portion of the technical net? Okay, very good. Once again, want to thank everyone who participated tonight. It's you guys that make or break a technical net, and I'm glad you indulged me with my mathematical discourse. I'll try not to do it too often. Remind everyone that if they have any questions for the tech net, if they have any topics they would like to hear discussed, if they have any puzzles they would like to share with me, or if they would like me to kind of tap Paul Felder and ask him to take a look at a video, YouTube, or website, what have you, and comment. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. There'll be links to the mathematical subjects that I discussed on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. And always keep in mind that there are archives of the Technical Net going back to September of 2006 available on my KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv site. So once again, thanks to everyone, and I'll be back a little bit later to tie it all up, but now it's time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good, Roy. And okay on all those topics, including the Russians. You know, they've been at it for a long time. You know, half-truths all the time. I remember when Yuri Gagarin went up, you know, we believe that he was the first one to go, you know, complete orbit, you know, around the Earth and come back in a spaceship, you know, take off in a spaceship and land in a spaceship. But, you know, they kept it quiet what happened, you know, well, it was actually part of the plan. When he came back, his spaceship was not part of him. He had an ejection seat. So before they came in for a landing, he ejected out and had a parachute. And that was one of the requirements for Yuri Gagarin. He was very good at parachuting. And that was the plan, because the spacecraft was not suitable for, you know, and in those days for landing safely. You know, he most likely would have injured or killed the cosmonaut. So they tell everybody, yeah, he went around, he landed, and everybody assumed it was this, you know, a spacecraft that he landed in. So it really wasn't until, and they did this for quite a few flights, it really wasn't until John Glenn actually landed in his Friendship 7 and, you know, and successfully won, you know, in a spaceship and landed in a spaceship. Anyway, that's my, I'm always concerned when it comes to the Russians. WS. Okay, anyway, let me just start off with an important launch. I talked about this, I think, for the last 2 weeks, but it's coming up on the 29th of September, and that previous Sunday we won't have a TechNet, so I'll just bring this up again. The Cygnus spacecraft is a cargo vehicle that goes to the International Space Station that's launched on an Antares rocket built by Northrop Grumman now. And it's a night flight, and it will be launched at 10:27 p.m. on that day. And you'll be able to see it if you have a low view of the horizon, around 15-20 degrees above the horizon, you should be able to see the light of the engines, the RD-181, actually Russian engines is what they use on the Antares rocket, as it goes east over the Atlantic, you know, as it goes uphill to orbit. Yeah, I thought I'd bring that up. And a couple of other important missions coming up, but they're not until October. Middle of October, October 14th, you have a launch from Kazakhstan. The Russians will launch in a Soyuz rocket with three crew men and three crew people, and one of the people is Dr. Kate Rubens, a ham radio operator, KG5FYJ. She's been up to the space station before. Now she's going to go again for another 6 months. Her visit, and she's the one into microbiology and all of that. She's got a doctorate in that. And then you'll have for about a week a crew of six of the International Space Station until a week later, October 21st, when another crew comes back on another Soyuz rocket. which will include Chris Cassidy, the NASA astronaut, and also I am KF5 KDR. So that'll be good. They're the most important. There's other watches and things going on, but to me, they're three important ones I'm watching. And then soon after that, you'll actually have a launch from Launch Complex 39A down in Florida. You'll have the crew of four going up on one rocket, on a Falcon 9 rocket. And the Dragon spacecraft crew vehicle, which will go and dock to the International Space Station. And this might happen, at the end of October. As early as that, it might be delayed. But whenever that does happen, you'll have a permanent crew of seven on board the space station. So let me start off with that. And I'm going to switch over to another spacecraft that's orbiting Jupiter at this time in a polar orbit. And that's called Juno. Juno was launched back in 2011, I think. And it eventually went into orbit around Jupiter in July, about 4 years ago, 2016. So it's been in orbit around 4 years. It was supposed to have a shorter mission than it did. Right now it's in a 53-day orbit. It takes 53 days to go around the North Pole and the South Pole. It's very elliptical. And their goal was to shorten that to a 14-day orbit. But they realized at some point that they had problems with the main engine on Juno. Possible malfunction. And they, rather than take a chance, there's a check valve involved, and they saw a problem in the telemetry. So rather than take a chance and go into this 14-day orbit where they would have gotten the science much quicker, they left it at a 53-day orbit, which it's still in today, and did the same amount of science. The only problem is it took, four years to complete instead of, like, they would try to do it in half that time. So, they've gone through their initial mission and a slightly extended mission. Now they plan on getting a much more extended mission coming up. It could last for years, until at least 2025. And in doing that, Juno will be able to come very close to some of the moons, like Io or Ganymede and Europa, maybe even Callisto. The idea of Juno was to study the planet itself, really to study Jupiter, the interior, by all its instruments, cameras. But now that part of it's over, the orbit will slightly change over time, bringing it closer to some of these planets, sometimes as close as, 100 miles off the surface. And with that, they'll be able to study in depth some of the moons going around Jupiter, which will be added to the science that was done many years ago with Galileo. Galileo, the idea of Galileo was to study not only Jupiter, but also the moons of Jupiter. And they got a lot of information back there. They could have gotten a lot more, but Galileo's main antenna never completely deployed on the way to Jupiter. So the data rate was much slower. But they got a lot back. They just used the same idea as this, extended missions time to get a lot more data back. So that's the story on Juno. Before I go on, any questions? Okay, this is WS2N. And I don't have all that much tonight, but here's a rocket program that was just canceled. I've talked about it on the net before. It's called Omega. And Omega was part of the Northrop Grumman system. They were building a solid booster rocket that would have been a heavy lift vehicle. the idea was to launch these heavy satellites that that the government, our government, want, you know, puts into a geosynchronous orbit, and they were going to compete with, you know, other rocket companies like the Atlas V, which is commonly used, or the Delta Four, or the Delta Four Heavy, or now even SpaceX's Falcon 9 Heavy. So they spent like millions of dollars on developing this. They had hardware done. They had the tower half built. They were going to use the other tower at Cape Canaveral. Right now, there's two main launch facilities at Cape Canaveral. It's 39A, which is now being utilized by SpaceX with their Falcon 9 rocket launches, and then there's 39B, which is, you know, it was almost a duplicate of 39A. In fact, not quite half, but a lot of shuttle flights will launch from 39B and 39A. So they're near each other. And since SpaceX is using 39A, 39B is going to be used for, you know, by NASA and its big rocket, the SLS, the Space Launch System, which will eventually launch rockets like the Orion with a crew in it to the moon and eventually Mars. But that pad was only going to be used maybe once a year for these type of launches. For the other half of the year, they had turned it over to Northrop Grumman to launch this Omega rocket, which is it's a big rocket. Probably a 290-foot tall rocket. It was all solid fuel rocket, and they had the goal of eventually launching a crew on it. So they apparently haven't had much luck with these solid fuel rockets lately over the decades. Now they canceled Omega. Before that, there was the Liberty that they were going to build. That was going to be a solid booster, solid second stage as well. Rocket, they canceled that. Before that, they had the Ares. Ares 1 actually did launch. That was back in the George Bush days. You know, they had the Constellation program and the Ares 1 was launched, and they realized they had some problems with that, you know, with the data that came back. It successfully went up, but too much vibration, and they felt, well, it's going to be too much work to eventually get a crew in that thing. So that was eventually canceled as well. So much for the solid booster rockets, but not to feel bad for Northrop Grumman. You know, they did cancel this for a reason. Our government chose not to give them any contracts for these multi-billion-dollar government launches, you know, spy satellites and the like. They in turn are giving them to Boeing and Lockheed and SpaceX. But sure enough, Northrop Grumman's got this like $30 billion contract recently for intercontinental ballistic missiles using the same type of technology, these solid booster rockets. So nobody's complaining at Northrop Grumman. Any other questions or comments? WS1.
KC1SAM, I've got a question.
KC1SAM? Oh, yeah, go ahead, Sam.
Well, when they have the 7 astronauts on there as a normal complement, or crew complement, what are their escape vehicles if they have to leave? You've got to have more than one, right?
More than one what? I missed that. I lost that word. More than one what?
Escape vehicle. If they have to leave the space station. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the flight rules are for everybody that's on that space station, there has to be a seat for them to get back in case there was an emergency on the space station. So, for instance, last 10 years, they've had a crew generally of six people. So six people, that means that those six people got there on Soyuz rockets. Each one carries three people. And there's enough docking ports on the Russian side to accommodate those Soyuz rockets. So they have left there permanently, you know, until they're ready to go back. They could last up to 6 or 7 months before their time is up. You know, that's how much time they give give these vehicles. So, you know, 6 months later, they'll get into their Soyuz rocket and go back and land in Kazakhstan. That's where they take off from as well. So, you know, that's the rule. Now, when we have seven people up there, that means on a regular basis, you're going to have at least one Soyuz vehicle attached with three. And then you're going to have a Dragon vehicle, also capable of spending 6, 7, 8 months attached to the space station with up to four people. So, you know, everybody has a seat for their return. And even when the shuttle went up there, and the shuttle would leave somebody there or whatever it might be, they might have sent two people up in a Soyuz at one time, and then there's an extra seat. And then, you know, when the shuttle came up and left somebody behind, you know, that person was now scheduled to go back on a Soyuz rocket. So that's the flight rules. You know, if you're on a space station, there's a seat waiting for you somewhere. And they're usually custom made to whatever person you are. So it's all figured way ahead of schedule. You know, a year in advance before you ever go up on your seat. Seat is designed for your body. Back to you, Sam. KC1SAM, WS2M.
KC1SAM. Yeah, I knew about the flight rules, and they had Soyuz up there. So the new configuration will be a Soyuz and a Dragon. Okay, that's what I did, and that's what I was curious about. So that gives you three and four. Thank you, sir.
Okay, yeah, I thought you had a good idea of that, but yeah, other people listening might find that interesting. And there's plenty of docking ports. You know, you have four docking ports on the Russian side, and they can accept either a crew vehicle, like a Soyuz rocket, or a cargo vehicle, like a Progress ship that docks at the space station. And then on the other side, the American side, we now have four docking ports. And they're a little different setup. We have two set for cargo vehicles, and then the other two are now set for crew vehicles. So, you know, theoretically, we could have two Dragons, for instance, or one Dragon and a Starliner built by Boeing, which will probably go up next year, filling those ports. So, you know, you could have you could have eight people on one side, and you could have, let's say, three or six on the other side. You know, you temporarily you have all these people on the space station, and that's the way it works. All right, let me continue on, unless somebody else has a question. Okay, there's a rocket I've talked about in the past. New companies I try to follow. Quite a few of them. I'm always interested to see if they, you know, ever make it to the launch pad. Yeah, that's the way SpaceX started out. They originally launched Kwajalein Island out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And they launched the Falcon 1 rocket, and it failed. Another Falcon 1 rocket, and it failed. And another one. Three of them. You know, each one getting better and better. And finally, the fourth one, Elon Musk was running out of money, and his fourth one made it to orbit. And right after that, NASA gave him a contract, and you know, they put a Falcon 1 rocket. He had plans on a Falcon 5 rocket. Well, now he's got money coming in. He skipped 5, and he went right to the Falcon 9 rocket. So I follow the smaller companies, wondering if they're ever going to make it like Elon Musk did. And it's companies like Relativity, which is still developing 3D printed rockets and engines. They haven't, they haven't flown yet. Another company called Vector. I thought they were going to make it. And these are small rockets. I thought they were doing pretty good, and something happened, and all of a sudden they went there. I think they went bankrupt. There's another one called Astra. I've been following Astra. Comes out of California, and they were originally signed up for the DARPA Prize. DARPA, offered. I think they would have got like $10 million or something. Out of DARPA. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. They always have these strange competitions. They're the same company that have cars that drive themselves all autonomous out in the middle of the desert. Whoever wins, gets millions of dollars, whatever the deal is. They have this multi-million-dollar prize for any company, small rocket company, that could launch a rocket anywhere within the United States, and then within, I think it was 10 days, launch another rocket from another spaceport, not the same spaceport, but somewhere else. The idea of this was to see if somebody could develop a rapid launch capability for small satellites. And some of them signed up, Virgin Virgin Orbital. They have the launcher. They call it the launcher rocket that attaches to a 747. It has not successfully made it to orbit yet, but they had signed up for the DARPA Prize, and then a couple of the other ones. But they eventually dropped out, and Astra was still in it, and the DARPA Prize to win the $10 million, whatever it was to, you had to complete this whole deal before a certain time. And in this case, it was early March of this year. And if you went past that time, the prize was canceled. So Astra made it to the launch complex. In this case, we have a launch complex up in Kodiak, Alaska, and I think they call it the Pacific Launch Complex now or something. It used to be called the Kodiak Launch Complex, and they got their rocket on the launch stand, and they're ready to go back in March, and something happened, and it just didn't take off, and then they had weather problems, and next thing they ran out of time within a day or two. But they still want to be in business. Their goal is to launch small satellites. So this week they got off the ground. They launched from Kodiak. I have one picture, nice picture with the mountain in the background and all. But the first, their first stage, the second stage, and then they run on typical rocket fuel, which is a refined kerosene and liquid oxygen, and it had five engines, Delphi engines they call them, all 3D printed. So it got off the ground, it took off, and I still don't know how far it got. It got like about a minute or so out, and according to the early reports that I heard so far, nothing confirmed yet. I thought originally that they said the first stage just shut down, and that was it. It came back down and crashed. But it turns out the reports are the navigation and control apparently went haywire, where it wasn't acting right, wasn't maybe pointing in the right direction as it was starting, as it was flying. So if that happens, it automatically shuts the engines down. But usually when they have those kind of launches and something like that happens, all these launch vehicles have explosives on board, and it's already, they detonate it. But apparently that didn't happen here for some reason. And it probably came down. It looks like it came down and hit the ground before it got, you know, over water. So, they were happy. This Astra company, they were happy to get off the ground. They said, even if we get off the ground, we're going to be happy with the first stage. And then we'll work on improving it. They think by the third launch, they should be able to make it to orbit. So it will be another company to watch in the future. They have electric-driven pumps, impellers, the pumps are driven by electric motors and lithium batteries. So it sounds like a similar design that a Rocket Lab is using down in New Zealand. They've launched 13 rockets now using that type of system. Rocket Lab has built a little bit bigger rocket, I think 80 or 90 feet tall. This thing was only 40 feet tall, 38 foot tall. I think they said you could put it in the back of a tractor trailer truck and drive it somewhere. So that's the story on that. Hopefully they do good. Any other questions before I go on? I guess not. I was going to bring this up last week. The Vega rocket has now returned to a service. Vega is part of the European Space Agency group of rockets. They have three different types of rockets. They have a small launch vehicle like Vega for smaller payloads. And then they have Soyuz, which they buy from Russia, and they launch from also from South America, French Guiana. And then they have the heavy lift vehicle, the Ariane 5, soon to be replaced by Ariane 6, I think, early next year. They plan on launching that. But Vega was out of service for about 8 months, I think, because they had a failure. They've returned to flight, and they launched 53 satellites last week, or the week before. I was going to talk about this last week. And on some of those 53 satellites, you have amateur radio satellites, which apparently went up. Don't have the information regarding it, whether or not they're functional now, or if some of these are just beacons. I'm not sure of their capabilities yet. I'll look into it. But at least they got themselves back up and running. And that's pretty much it. I don't really have much else to add tonight. If anybody has any questions, if not, we'll just turn it back to Roy. Any other comments or questions for the space portion of the TechNet? Nothing heard. We'll go back to Roy. See how he's doing. AC2GS, WS2N.
AC2LR, can you hear me?
Okay, stand by 1 second, Roy. I heard AC2LR. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, sorry. I have bad reception here. Do you know what is what scientific findings is Juno getting or sending back about the atmosphere of Jupiter?
Well, yeah, they've been studying the everything from what it consists of, the densities, and this and that. And one of the problems it solved was the scientists, for some reason, thought there should have been a large amount of ammonia or a larger percentage of ammonia in the atmosphere. Where is it? And through Juno, they were able to figure out that. The ammonia apparently is getting mixed with water, water vapor in the atmosphere, and then at some point it's condensing. It's freaking cold up there, and then it was turning into like a sludge almost. And then by doing that, it had weight, and then this ammonia/water ball would would fall through the atmosphere, and as it was falling through, it would actually create lightning, similar to what happens here on Earth when it rains. So, electrons get ripped off and everything, and they found out that, you know, that's one of the causes of a lot of lightning. And they found out that these sludge, they call them, I think they said sludge balls or something, of ammonia and water would go into, deep into the atmosphere and essentially disappear, and they figured out that that's why there's this missing percentage of ammonia. That's the latest thing that I read on that. Okay, back to you.
Thanks. Last year, I heard one of the spacecrafts was going to one of the outer gas giants or ice giants, and there was a thought that maybe as carbon was falling in this very dense gravity, that it could...
Let me see if I have it. Okay, you said carbon falling, very dense gravity, and then you drop that. Okay. Okay, maybe we'll get Kay back. It's one of my favorite spacecraft, Juno, anyway. When it did a flyby by Earth in 2013 for a gravity assist. You know, it goes around the sun, comes around a complete orbit around the sun, and it comes near Earth again. It uses Earth as a slingshot to get extra speed to head out to Jupiter. And on that trip, they wanted to test the plasma instrument on board Jupiter, on board Juno. And to do that, they asked amateur radio
complete
community to see if they would, you know, go along with this. And they had the system set up, and you know, JPL had laid out this whole idea of transmitting the word hi, H-I, you know, did it, you know, but not that fast. It was very slow. I mean, it took like forever to, you know, you had to push the key, did, you know, and then repeat this, you know, over and over at certain times. The idea is if everybody on Earth was all the amateurs transmitting the signal at the exact same time, let me drop it. And I think they wanted 10 meters or something was popular a band, but if they were doing it at the same time, that would increase the signal coming out of Earth, and then they were able to check the plasma unit, make sure it was working before it ever got to Jupiter. You know, way of calibrating it, and apparently it worked, and JPL was happy about this, and they sent the QSL cards to anybody that participated. I got one, and I believe Kay got one too. Let me see if she's back. AC2LR, WS2N. Okay, I know she probably here. It's probably in a bad spot. But back over to you, Roy. I don't have anything else for now. AC2GSWS2N.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Always great to hear the space that report. Hopefully next week Andy will be back for Andy's Corner as well. As I've mentioned before, next week the Rosh Hashanah, and just before the TechNet begins. So I got 14 minutes to start everything up. So if I start a little late, hopefully you'll wait for me. The following Sunday on the 27th is Yom Kippur. I'll be radio silent, so there'll be no TechNet that night. But as always, want to remind everyone that if you have any questions or topics or puzzles, or you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links are available to the stories that I gave and the puzzles that I gave. You can find that at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, MikeKC2NJI's website, amateurradio.tv, has archives of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006. Once again, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. It's you people that make the difference between a good tech net and me babbling on.
As always, I want to remind you of Dick, K2RIW, a very wise man, and had a very wise advice at the end of his technical nets, which is be kind to each other. It's good advice at any time, but especially during these times of the coronavirus. So please be safe. Don't be frightened, but be smart about everything. And I wish you a happy and healthy week. To those who celebrate Rosh Hashanah, Shana Tova to you guys and gals. And again, wish you all well. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear.
WA1VVH.
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, what time did this net start? I tuned in about 9 o'clock, and I've been listening intently ever since. Just wondering, what time does it start?
We start at 8 p.m. every night. We're available either directly through the repeater. We have links to IRLP Belden repeater. We have echo links, and we even offer an audio stream of the net.
Well, I used to listen to this net back when K2RIW was active, and I was shocked to hear of his passing because I had been away for a while. About the better part of the year, medical and personal issues and so forth, but I got back on and people were telling me that he had passed on, so definitely hard to take. I knew him from VHF contesting years ago. WA1VVH.
Yes, indeed. It came to a shock for all of us, unfortunately. It's the way life works, unfortunately, but you sort of never expect it. And it was a bit like a sucker punch, but I think Dick would have wanted the technical net to persist onward. He was incredibly proud of what he had done in all the years. I think 38 years that he had done on the technical net, and so part of this is a memorial to him.
QSL, very happy to hear that it's still going on. That I'm just sort of getting back on here and tuning around. So good to hear it going on. It was extremely interesting tonight. I've got a couple of local friends up here that would very much like to check in, so I'm going to pass the information along for next time. WA1VVH, thanks for the info.
You're welcome. Have a good week, and please invite other people. The parts is greater than the whole is greater than the sum of our parts. So please invite your friends who are technically interested, curious, or knowledgeable. The more the merrier.
Three.
Okay, Doc. Once again, this is AC2GS, and I will be clear.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30.